This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and Bradley is off this week, so I've got Andrew Jewell here with me, and we're going to talk about today's Apple event and some other things alongside it. For this show, we got three sponsors, the first being Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite, device management tool for Macs, iPods, iPhones, iPads, Apple TVs, and all the great Apple tools. Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/outofschool and enter the offer code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. And finally, iDev Books, a Finnish app design company who have been making iOS maths apps for 5 years now. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to see you. What's been going on since last time you were on?
I think the last time I was on was just after, it wasn't the last Apple announcement, but it was the one maybe before that.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, so it's been a good while. So loads of things have changed personally for me. So I'm maybe a little bit less in Cedars now and more kind of all over the place, looking at schools and doing a lot of professional development training with different schools, mostly in Edinburgh, but also in various other parts of the country as well.
So for listeners who have picked up the show since Andrew was last on the show, Andrew has been and still is a colleague of mine at Cedars, previously full-time primary teacher, and now part-time primary teacher and part-time roving iPad specialist. As you said, all over the place as well. So you've been Scotland. Where else have you been?
Over the years, I've done a lot of work in Denmark, and that recently was in Iceland recently, which was nice. I would love to go back there. Didn't have enough time, but that was fun. Just kind of looking at they're starting off with some really interesting and significant iPad deployments over there, so that was fun. And a few jobs down south, and various kind of different sectors, independent sector and obviously state schools in and around Edinburgh and Scotland.
So you're obviously seeing quite a range of different things in different schools.
Yeah, I think in many ways that's been the really interesting aspect of it. And I think maybe to give a bit of background to what I'm actually doing this year, I think probably when we first got the iPad, obviously in 2010, the one thing I would have said was that you just need to put it into the hands of teachers and they would do great things with it.
Yeah.
And I think probably my one kind of the biggest change for me has been that opinion, and I would have thought training was really pretty unnecessary at that stage, whereas now I'm kind of more convinced, both for myself to keep up to date and whatever, but also to see successful practice of using these technology in schools, that it's just a vital part of what we do.
Yeah, and I think also it's something that Bradley and I have talked about a lot on the show, is that over those years iOS has gotten a lot more complex as well. So when we started, it actually was quite easy for anybody to sort of grasp the entirety of what was possible on iOS. And now it's very much not that way.
Yeah, that's very true.
You know, and particularly also with the number of apps. I mean, the number of iPad apps that we had at our disposal, I think we probably used them all back in the day, you know. But now there's, what did Tim Cook say today, 675,000 iPad-specific apps.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm intensely aware now that the way I think about the iPad and what it can do is very much determined by the set of apps that I have installed.
Yeah.
And I think actually, you know, as you've seen as well with iOS 8, that the capabilities you have to interconnect these apps is actually determined by which apps you have installed as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And also I think, the apps is probably one of the major mistakes, if you like, that I personally made when we first had the iPad, which I guess, you know, and you see people making that mistake still.
Yeah.
And of just thinking that it's all about the number of apps and that there are very sort of specific apps for very specific tasks. And I think that can be fine, but you also are missing the kind of interconnected nature of the iPad and in education there. And I think part of what I'm doing is really saying, you know, here's a limited number of tools, just try these tools and use these tools wherever you are and whatever circumstances or curricular areas you're working in, whatever.
Because in a way what you're doing there is you're throwing back the job of I suppose, motivating or educating, or I'm not quite sure what the word to use there is, but you're throwing it back onto the teacher's resilience to really come up with a good educational experience in the classroom that incorporates technology, rather than saying, if I give you an iPad and this app, you'll get certain results.
Yeah.
Is that kind of fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And also I think the underlying pedagogy, if you like, of education is still there. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm trying to do often is kind of like just kind of crack the ice almost like of the iPad and get down to that again.
Yeah.
And let people realise that that's all still there. So mm-hmm. in terms of interdisciplinary learning and a lot of these kind of these types and just the interconnectedness of education and making links between prior learning and mm-hmm. where you are now and the power of research and, you know, incorporating that into what you're doing and learning and where the outcomes to learning happen and where they fit in and assessment and some of these real fundamental kind of heavyweight concepts in education that they're still there. And I often kind of feel like I'm doing is just, as I say, drilling down and just showing people that the iPad is still hitting these, you can really hit these kind of significant fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was listening to another podcast recently where Steve Jobs and John Lasseter, there's a clip from an interview that both of those guys did just after Toy Story came out.
Yeah.
And the interviewer asked them, he said, you know, what does a computer bring you in animation? And John Lasseter said, we just look at computers as big, expensive, fast pencils. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of where I feel that we've come to with iPad, is that it's just a big, expensive, fast pencil. And although you could look at that as a thing that sort of diminishes its importance, it actually kind of increases it as well, because you know, it just lets you do so much more.
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, the Pixar Render Farm is a more powerful tool than one Disney animator's drawing board.
Mm.
You know, they're still both ways to draw things and tell a story, but one is substantially more powerful and unlocks a whole new range of capabilities than the other. And I think that's a useful way to think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the power, to me, still of the iPad is that it reaches beyond the kind of boundaries of people's fears of technology.
Mm.
So, you know, you can still see within a fairly short space of time, I think often, that teachers who would describe themselves as very kind of technophobic or mm-hmm. you know just not into technology in whatever way, I mean teachers who would maybe come to your training session and with a handful of hand drawn worksheets that they want to know, you know, this is what I do, how do I do this on the iPad, then, you know, very quickly the iPad has the potential to kind of get beyond that and just, I think, powerfully show them that there are things that they want to do on the iPad, even though they maybe don't know that yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. so that can actually save them time, or that can, you know, do what they're doing in a more efficient way. And and I still find that's quite a thrill. You know,
mm-hmm.
when you meet people like that, and they go away, and you hear, like, in the staff room, they've been saying, oh, wait, you see how you can do this with Explain Everything or whatever, and you realise that they've actually almost unwittingly stumbled into technology
mm-hmm.
in a space of just a few hours, you know?
Yeah.
Because they've seen a way that it can do what they want to do in a way that they can do it.
You mentioned Explain Everything there, which is a tool that's got a lot of play on the show.
Mm.
We've talked about it several times, you know, both with you, we've had Roshan on the show a couple of times as well. And I'm curious to know sort of what is in that toolkit that you're introducing new teachers to. What do you go for first?
In terms of apps,
yeah.
I mean, it's that's really interesting actually, because I've seen, like, talking about the variety of what schools are doing. Like, I've seen some schools have been very successful or fairly successful with what they've done with the iPad, but in a specific field. So, for example, you know, iTunes U.
Mm-hmm.
So iTunes U is a great tool, obviously, and some schools are using that really well. But I've been in schools where it's almost as if the iPad is basically a tool to run iTunes U.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do with iTunes U is great. And so some of what I've been doing there is saying, well, okay, you know how to take your PowerPoints and all your, you know, your PDFs, and you know how to put them into your materials box in iTunes U, and you know mm-hmm. how to attach them to your assignments and so on. But let's think about how we can create content on the device and mm-hmm. And then just upload directly to your courses in iTunes U. So that's quite interesting, because some schools have done specific things very well, but it's as if they've left a whole kind of swathe of what you can do with the iPad untapped because they've focused on one specific area. Mm-hmm. Whereas other schools, particularly primary schools, have obviously focused on different areas. So maybe they've looked specifically at movies, and they've done a lot of work with iMovie, and they've done classes have done kind of like their iMovie trailers, and they've done a lot of big writing activities and then recorded the movie. So they've maybe done a lot on that, but they've not thought about some of the kind of apps that allow them to mark PDFs or create pupil profile books in Book Creator, for example, or, you know, things that are actually really useful to them.
You often see that with Keynote as well. You know, there's a big major, and that's certainly something I do in my classes. We spend a lot of time working with Keynote, and we do it to a certain extent throughout the school at Cedars, but I have particular responsibility for some parts of that.
Yeah.
And you sometimes see that as well, like, you know, everything becomes a Keynote deck.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is actually quite good training for corporate life these days.
Where are they going to go?
Your expense report. I used to have a job where my expense report had to be handed in PowerPoint format. Because that was the only app we could guarantee that everybody had.
Yeah.
You know, because everything was, and all the documentation for all the software was in Keynote or PowerPoint.
I mean, that's quite an interesting point, actually. I was in a school just last week, in fact, this week, on Tuesday, and one of their classes, they were doing presentations, and they were working on paper, so big paper, and they'd done a lot of research, and you know, it was a kind of Scottish theme, some sort of Scottish industry. I think their presentations were on Scottish industries.
So whiskey.
Whiskey was definitely there. Yeah, whiskey was one of them, and you know, tweed and other things, but. But it was interesting because that school have had a netbooks program, so they have had access to PowerPoint, but they had decided to, at this stage, you know, forget the slides and actually just go with the actual presentation. And I found it was, you know, I was quite pleased by that, because I think one of the things that you find with the technology is sometimes you go in and you see that the technology has become almost like the default go-to. Like you say, the minute you say we're gonna do a talk, everything is immediately thinking about their PowerPoint slides or their Keynote slides. Yeah. And in actual fact, the quality of the talk can be pretty variable. And sometimes you wonder if the technology can sometimes be a negative rather than a positive in some of these kind of situations.
I believe very strongly you have to build into the assessment a certain level of restraint, such that going over the top with the digital production in a way that's detrimental to the communication part is actually penalised in the marking scheme, that it's not just, you don't just give a pass because they used Keynote or they used Pages or whoever, that you have to recognise the possibility that you could actually go too far into the digital and actually detract from what it is you're trying to do.
Yeah, we've seen that, you know, sometimes with kids that have produced phenomenal Keynote presentations, but they won't stand up and give them because they don't have the confidence to stand up for whatever reason, or they're not comfortable with that. And so that's quite an interesting angle on some of these things as well.
Yeah. Do you feel like most schools have a curriculum that's ready for going one-to-one?
My goodness, that's a good question. I mean, certainly from what I've seen in Scotland, I think the curriculum itself as a framework up to a point adapts very well to the iPad and to one-to-one with the iPad and a device that is a kind of, you know, a personal mobile learning device. But up to a point, because obviously you'll know this better than me, that we seem to reach a ceiling where everything from, you know, the rocket begins to kind of slow down when it hits the ceiling of the structure of exams and, you know, what they're required to do for these exams and how they're required to do it. So immediately all sorts of other constraints come in on their creativity and on all these other, you know, on the use of technology.
Yeah. And I suppose it is a challenge for us, particularly in Scotland, where we have to, in some ways, we have to figure out our own assessments up to a certain level, and then we get handed a certain kind of assessment late in the game.
Yeah.
And the challenge, I suppose, is making those match up.
Yeah.
you know, and it's kind of that kind of funny world of creativity, but let's make sure we always get repeatable results as well.
Yeah.
Creativity doesn't really work that way, you know.
Yeah, and then also I suppose creativity, but still within a, you know, on the right road, so that although we're although we're allowing them to be creative in how they're travelling, we're not saying it's still got to be on this road that is ultimately going to where we want it to go. Which I also think that one of the things I'm seeing is that one of the key fundamentals that I think a lot of schools haven't really come to terms with is, you know, you need structure to be able to make this work. So you need structure in your assessment. If you're going to use the iPad, how are you going to assess what you're going to do?
Yeah.
And you need structure in, you know, keeping records and backup copies. And you need to know if somebody comes in next year and says, what did he get for that particular assignment? Where is that assignment?
Yeah, keeping a track.
How did you do that? Yeah, where is it living and how long does it live there? And so I think there's a lot of questions out there to be answered around about all of that. And that's where, you know, increasingly, whether you like creativity or not, there is some degree of standardization that needs to happen.
We certainly worked a lot on that with more kind of rubric-based assessment rather than test-based assessment. So because Curriculum for Excellence invites us to offer personalization and choice as well as just experiences and knowledge and so on, that we can deliver that personalization and choice through the student can choose the form of the assessment. But then it requires quite a level of sophistication to get a really good rubric that can correctly analyse the learning without falling victim to assessing the form of the learning. You know, and I think that's an incredible challenge, and it requires year over year refinement. And it is impossible to get right before you try it. I'm using some rubrics that I've written this year for things like photo essays and rubrics for interactive museum kiosks and things like that, and I've been tuning. We started off with one just for presentations, which has been fairly robust but needs a bit of work now, and then taking the kind of spirit of that but interpreting other forms in that same spirit, that you sort of penalise overuse of the digital but also recognise that you've done a good job at the same time. And you find, like, children always find incredible ways around the rules that you set, you know. So I had one example where we were doing a presentation thing, and the strict rule to start with was 10 slides, no more, no less. And it was 3 introductory slides and then 6 slides in 3 pairs about 3 points and then a concluding slide. And one student who I had a big conversation with them, and they had like 14 slides in their deck. I said, no, you've got to cut it down to 10 just because that's what I've said, you've got to do it. And then so back and forth, and then they did their first presentation, and I went back and watched the video of it, and they had 14 slides worth of content. But I had a copy of their keynote deck and they only had 10 slides in it. I was like, how has that happened? And what it was that they had done, instead of having 14 slides, there was one slide where they would show a screen full of content and then they would build it all out and build in another screen full of content. So they actually had 14 slides worth.
So the build.
I'm not at all happy when I confronted them about the fact that they had very elaborately worked around the rule. But it's things like that that are, you know, there's always a way around these rules.
You know,
but it's important, I think, when you're teaching and assessing in that way, to firstly, the first phase of my development with that was to write the rubric and share it in advance, right? And but the deeper level, I think, is to actually collaboratively build the rubric with the class. So ask them, how do you think this should be assessed? And I've started to do that a bit more this year as well. So some of that, the photo essay stuff, you know, what do you think makes a good photo essay? We looked at a lot of photo essays on like Lightbox on the Time Magazine website. They're also really good things, and had them try and extract what makes something worthy of that level of presentation, and then try and pull out what are the key points and then build that rubric together and then assess based on that.
Which is brilliant, because that's got so many more aspects of learning in it. And even the research, obviously they're researching with a key fundamental aim of ultimately making their own. You know, so and also developing the assessment that you're going to use when you look at theirs, which is I mean, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. it's interesting because it's time consuming, but it's also, it just feels much more valuable.
Yeah.
You know.
So I noticed this, I think the first time that this sort of thing was when we'd been doing something on percentages in maths,
mm-hmm.
and I'd taken the kids down to the local mall and basically said, okay, you know, you're on a hunt for percentage signs. So they were going around, they were literally taking photographs in groups,
mm-hmm.
of, you know, 10% off signs and, you know, half price sale posters and things like that.
Yeah.
And then we came back to the classroom and I'd made, basically made a textbook, which was like a catalogue really, in Book Creator. And it just had photographs with prices underneath, and then each page was a different sale, so it was like 10% off.
Mm-hmm.
And they just worked in their exercise books, but used the iPad as a textbook and that I'd made, basically, and mm-hmm. worked through the textbook and gave the new prices.
Yeah.
But then what we did, which I think is fantastic in Book Creator, obviously you can use, you can make templates and you can share templates. So I had like two kids at the front saying, you guys are working together, you're now making your own textbook and you're going to share it with the guys at the back.
Mm.
And what was fascinating in that was that, you know, I'd been looking at my kind of learning outcomes, if you like, were looking at 10% off, 20% off, 30% off, 70% off.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately the kids at the front were like, well, if they're going to do our textbook, you know, forget that, they're going to do it. We're having a 12.5% off sale, you know. And immediately they're going to
screw
like,
up the other half of the class.
Yeah, so yeah. So these guys are like, we don't know how to do that. And then immediately you've got this conversation happening about, mm-hmm. well, how do we know how to do 12.5% off? How do we work that out?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we could find 10% and then 5% and then 2.5% and so on. So immediately, like, the whole level of the learning in the room,
mm-hmm.
just went to a level that I hadn't really planned.
Yeah.
And it was simply because rather than them consuming the textbook as a textbook,
mm-hmm.
they were also creating it with a view to other people consuming it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really powerful tool when it comes to
mm-hmm.
actually taking the kids and giving them some kind of control over their own learning.
Yeah.
And extending them, you know.
Let me take a minute to tell you about Jam Software. Jam Software provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TV in education. And with Castor Focus, they can put these technologies right into the hands of teachers who work with students every day. Their app, Castor Focus, allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select the specific Apple TV assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even start AirPlay right from Castor Focus. Learn what else you can do with Castor Focus at jamsoftware.com. The challenge for a secondary teacher is to keep that going further up the school.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the thing I'm struggling with the most at the moment, is that I have all these tools and almost no scope to really use a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, of course we use the web and we use, you know, we'll use Explain Everything, we'll use iMovie at different times,
but
so much of it, the further up you go, is just, you know, here's the National 5 textbook, here's the higher textbook. Let's just learn it, and here's your exam at the end.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that I don't struggle with it because I don't have any power to change it.
Yeah.
Yet, but it's something that feels uncomfortable, and because I have to manage that transition from what you've just described into what is essentially an extremely traditional exam system.
Yeah.
The same that we sat in school, and the same that, and literally our parents sat in school as well. You know, the Scottish Higher. The content's new, okay, and the percentages of coursework versus exam have been tweaked 5% up and down in different courses. But I think the class I teach, Admin and IT, is one of the few where it's actually a skills-based assessment rather than a knowledge-based assessment.
Yeah.
You know, you have to actually sit down and work on the computer and produce content, produce work, and then that's sent away and assessed. And I think that's a promising sign for the future. That they can do that for at least one course, but it would be interesting to see how could you take that assessment model and apply it to, say, you know, higher maths. You have to build a bridge and send it off and see if it works, you know. The cost of doing that, I don't know if you could afford to do that for a subject where you have 60,000 entrants in a year.
That's the other aspect of all of it, I suppose.
The time cost of assessment in this kind of progressive education is very high.
Yeah.
So you got to pick your battles. Yeah, as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose one of the things that, in that regard, that I saw fairly recently was a school where they were using book creator to share basically literacy and numeracy profile records with the kids. So effectively the students had an empty book that was their literacy portfolio for the year or the 2 years that were their level that they were working at.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was their responsibility to basically populate that book with content for beneath each outcome heading. So,
okay.
You know, they had the template was basically empty except for the outcomes from the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And then the students had to go then and say, okay, today we've just done an essay in whatever, it hits this specific outcome in literacy, so I'm going to put that in. And I think where that's quite interesting is it allows the student themselves to get an overview of how successful they think they are being at achieving the various outcomes that they're mm-hmm. being ultimately assessed by you or me or whoever their teacher is on. But it gives them a kind of very immediate kind of like feeling of how they're doing.
It's a dashboard for their own progression, isn't it?
Yeah. Which I think is one way of doing some of these things. And
well, I mean, that's another topic that we've talked about a lot in the show is the concept of like learning analytics and learning dashboards and things. And I think in general, you know, Brad and I have been quite down on that whole idea because it's often presented in such a way that it's actually of no benefit to the learner, but it's all benefit to the management.
Yeah.
You know, and the management has this kind of panopticon where they can sit at a dashboard and they can see how anybody's doing, but that information is not necessarily transparent to the student. I think what you're describing there is something that is actually put into the hands of the individual as a self-reflective tool rather than just as an analytical measurement on some kind of school or district-wide dashboard. I think that's a powerful, and I think the more that those tools come into schools, the more they have to be transparent to everybody and not just be a sort of a tool for the school management, and by that I'm sort of including the teacher as well.
Yeah,
it's got to be something that the students themselves get to see.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, and I think that's one thing that, you know, one of the things I've done for a couple of years now is show people the digital report card that we did mm-hmm. as a pilot in my class a couple of years back.
Yeah,
and you know, people all over the world, teachers are amazed by it, but at the same time, the question everywhere is just like kind of very sort of quite cynical, and understandably so, because it's just like, well, yeah, how long does that take?
Yeah,
and there's no way that in a class of 30 kids, I'm going to have time to, you know, collate all the digital content that goes into one of these report cards.
Yeah.
And that's a very valid comment, and it also, obviously, that was built in iBooks Author, and it went home on the iPad, and etc. And it was amazing, and it was received really well by the parents, mm-hmm. but it isn't practical in terms of, you know, a larger class size, and in most teachers' environments. But this is where I think, you know, what we're talking about here is interesting in that, you know, if we give the students the template for their report card on their mm-hmm. iPad, and then they begin to say, you know, you have a particular assessment that you've done, and they don't even need to email you that particular assessment, you just need to see it. And then you can say, well, yeah, drop that into
mm-hmm.
your report. And then they can begin to, over the course of a year, build up their own report. Then I think that's a really powerful thing, because they have the facility then to judge and assess themselves on a kind of very formative way. Mm-hmm. So they're able to see, well, that was my mark, you know.
Yeah.
I could probably do better than that. And because they're involved in the collation process, mm-hmm. which to me is a really powerful thing.
Yeah,
it could be.
There's something I'm kind of doing a little bit with a class that I've got at the moment, where we're working on kind of, they're building like an interactive museum kiosk using the interactive hyperlinks in Keynote on the iPad.
Mm.
So they just use it's just a linear slide deck, but on every slide they're building buttons to jump around. It's almost a wee bit HyperCard-ish.
Yeah.
If you remember back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day.
And it's given me such a retro glow. I love this class. But one of the things I did with them was that we developed a rubric together. And then what I said was, like, here's your four hand-in things. You've got to hand in your outline, your sort of tree diagram of the layout of the navigation. You've got to hand in the Keynote deck yourself. And you've got to hand in a completed rubric for your own thing. So they've got to actually mark themselves and hand it in as well. And then there'll be an interesting measurement at the end as to what their opinion of themselves was versus what my opinion of them was as well. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, I mean, that's, I think, a really fundamental thing that's way beyond technology.
Yeah.
When you're actually getting the kids to...
It's almost post-technological.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that you do because you're using technology, but I think it's something that's, it's often, like, I don't know that a lot of places I've been to have really kind of gone beyond the technology. So it's kind of like you do this thing and then you do it in the technological presentation,
yeah,
and that's fine. As long as you get it done, that's fine.
Yeah.
But starting to actually kind of look at the technological part of it in the context of the whole production and being able to judge the technology use as precisely as you would judge the learning as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's something I'm just starting to get really to grips with as well.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about iDevBooks, a Finnish app design company that's been making iOS maths app for 5 years. iDevBooks has 26 maths apps from column addition to polynomial long division. When Edudemic selected the iDevBooks maths apps among the 20 best education apps and web tools of the year, they said that the apps are focused on making the concepts easy to learn rather than being bogged down with bells, whistles, and ads. Listeners of this podcast can now get any iDevBooks math app for free by using the feedback form at idevbooks.com. Just so you heard about the offer on the show, and please remember to say which app you would like. Your email address will only be used to send you a code for the app, and the offer is valid through the end of the year, but please hurry as there are only a limited number of free apps available. That's idevbooks.com.
I mean, in some ways, this isn't the most interesting time of the kind of era that we've lived through, of the kind of birth of iPad and mm-hmm. certainly its use in schools, because we're really starting to move past the kind of excitement of the technology and actually mm-hmm. really noticing that it's changing things quite fundamentally mm-hmm. beyond and below and around the actual technology itself.
I don't know if it was you that, I think probably was you the last time we had this conversation, but I always end up quoting Seymour Papert in this.
I'm happy to be quoted by
he talks about the idea that, you know, you bring computers into school for one purpose or multiple purposes possibly, but he, in his kind of terminology, you know, you sort of, once you go one to one, things start to happen in the school as part of the life and the operation of the school that nobody could have anticipated when he first proposed that kind of program.
Yeah.
And I think that's the conversation that we're having here is essentially exactly that. That this isn't, we didn't sit down when we first looked at iPad or iPod Touch or whatever it was we were going to get and say, well, this could be the backbone of a massive higher order thinking skills program.
Yeah.
But it's sort of starting to feel a bit like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And as we mature into, you know, this is our fifth year of being wholly one-to-one, that we're not really looking for ways or reasons to use the iPad anymore. The reasons are sort of there and they present themselves in whatever constrained context we have to work at different levels of the school. But it's about assuming that the computer is there and trying to figure out what that really means.
Mm.
Not just do we tick a box to say we use the computer this time so that justifies our spending and our costs, but really, have we used the computer well and appropriately?
Yeah.
You know, and many times, you know, beginner users don't use the computer appropriately at all. Sometimes they use it too much.
Yeah.
Other times they don't use it enough, you know. And that's the
challenge. And sometimes also, like what you've said there, that the way that you're thinking about learning has actually been changed, sometimes without you even realizing it, by the technology that you now have available, and mm-hmm. and the fact that maybe you've lived with that technology now for 3-4 almost 5 years, that just the way you're thinking about learning and assessment and some of these things has been changed,
mm-hmm.
you know, over time, imperceptibly sometimes.
Do you notice that when you go to other schools, that other people are not thinking the same way you're thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, and I'm not saying that by any in any shape or form as a kind of boast, or that we are in some ways ahead of the game in any great way because of what we've done brilliantly, but I just think that it is a bit of a curve, it's a journey,
mm-hmm.
You know, with you know, it sounds a bit philosophically cheesy, but
is it a reward or not is the question. But I understand what you mean, though. It's not that we're not necessarily better or smarter people than other teachers, it's just that we've been doing it longer.
Yeah.
And I think the longer you do it,
yeah,
the and more that changes.
It's like walking. It's like the two worlds merge,
mm-hmm.
and you know, in the merging of those, if you step out of your world into suddenly a world where everybody has the iPad and there's all these potential possibilities, then it actually, I think, takes your brain time to assimilate that and mm-hmm. actually begin to kind of like begin to experience that new world in whatever way you do. And I think that's why often schools kind of latch on to something that that they can connect immediately to what they already do. So they say, mm-hmm. iTunes U, we're all developing new courses, let's develop them through iTunes U because we want a digital platform where we can share content. So that's fine, and it's almost like a kind of go-to place for particularly secondary schools who want some way of saying the iPad's great because,
and here's a concrete thing.
Yeah,
that we
and
do this
we
year.
Understand this, and we know exactly how to do what we're doing with this, and it's kind of, and I think that's great. But
and that's of course why iTunes U exists.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
you know, that's a product that's the job it's doing for Apple, is to give those schools a bridge from we do all this stuff on paper to we can see a future in which we really genuinely utilize this device in every class.
Yeah.
Even if you don't do anything beyond that, it's at least a reason that every teacher has to get it out of the classroom or get out of the school.
Yeah, and that is amazing. And I think schools will find and teachers will find that. And sometimes I sometimes feel as if what I am doing is finding that one thing and saying, you know, you can do that in your class tomorrow. And mm-hmm. just seeing a teacher's eyes light up with, okay, right, that's useful.
Yeah.
And then you know that that is the start of a process. It's the start of a journey, if you like, into that new world
mm-hmm.
that will hopefully ultimately become something that generates some of the questions that we're talking about right now about assessment and learning and some of the big, deep, kind of fundamental attitude questions that we're looking at, you know?
But it takes so
and
long.
It takes so long.
I mean,
it does.
I've only really been thinking this way for about 18 months now.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and I've been involved in edtech since we started the school in '99.
Yeah,
and it's only now that I'm starting to realise, like, the long term implications of a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm the same. I sometimes find, you know, talking to you or talking to people, you know, like that are kind of in this world, it's almost as you talk these things out that suddenly you realise that your thinking is actually changing and mm-hmm. changed on a lot of these things.
Yeah. Well, we hope that works for the listeners too.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are so many challenges, and the challenges are so rich. It's still fascinating.
It's a little bit like I don't know how many times tonight Tim Cook said, you know, we can't wait to see what you're going to do with it. And he said that so many times. we can't wait to see what you're going to do with it. You know, but there is an element of that. Like, we would never have known what we were going to do with this 4 years ago.
I agree, and you know, I always say that if we had got to the point we got to after 6 months, that was where I expected to be after like 3 years.
Yeah,
you know, and it's, I suppose, a tribute to the developers who make the great apps for iPad that we were able to go so much further, so much more quickly but at the same time, you know, as much as Tim Cook wants to see what people do with it, there's a role for somebody like the job you're doing to come in and just tell people, start by doing this.
Yeah.
And I think if I've got one criticism of Apple over the past couple of years, it's been that they stopped telling people what to do with the iPad. And what they do now is they show videos of people doing like
amazing things.
Insanely cool things. Yeah. But I think to a certain proportion of the population, the coolness of the stuff they show is so far beyond the experience. I mean, I just rewatched a couple of videos because I was tweeting them. You know, you get the original iPad commercial where it was, what is iPad? iPad is thin, it's light, it's beautiful, it goes anywhere, it lasts all day.
Yeah.
It's, you know, 500,000 apps, all the books, all the videos.
Yeah.
And just in 30 seconds, just listed about 15 different use cases for the iPad.
Yeah.
Whereas now, this, you know, Add Your Verse video that they have, it's like, you know, a Japanese synth pop duo, and it's a guy with a quadricopter, and it's somebody doing deep sea diving, and it's a guy, you know, and okay, some of those are business contexts as well, but you know, it's these kind of like heroic uses of the iPad that are held up to be, you know, these are the great things you can, you know, the sort of the privileging of the creative class, I think, over the everyday, you know, and not everybody is as creative as that.
Yeah.
And to only, in some ways, to only highlight those creative aspects of the iPad over just, like, wouldn't it be great if it was just one of those videos where it's a guy sitting in a coffee shop doing all his email and then he goes home and plays with his kids because the iPad saved him 40 minutes of his day.
Yeah.
You know, I think I would love to see it.
Yeah, which is why
a courageous advert like that.
Yeah, which is why I suppose that the pencil ad was a really good one because it made a really powerful point there.
Yeah.
You know, it just said, this is the tool that you used all the time, every day, in wherever you were. You just had a pencil in your pocket.
Yeah.
And now this is the tool. So I think, yeah, I agree with you. And I think that kind of type of message is a really important one. And it's, I guess it's a hard one to kind of to communicate in a world where people think they already know what the iPad is and what it does. They know you can read your email on it and the newspaper, and you can do your Tesco shopping, or you know, it's sort of assumed that people know that, you know. So you're almost looking for a way to communicate. Yeah. Real life,
an actual thing. So I suppose that's a good way to segue into what happened today. Finally, I'd like to tell you about Squarespace. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/outschool and enter the offer code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. And I know that Bradley, for example, has already updated his website to use the new Squarespace version 7, which just came out. And I've been looking at that as well for my website, and I highly recommend that you check it out as well. They're full of e-commerce tools. If you pay by the year, you get a free domain name included. Every plan has got e-commerce available in it. There's nothing for you to install or manage or host. There are tools to let you update your blog from iOS, which I use that to write on my blog all the time. And they have 24/7 support, which is super helpful anytime you run into any problem. Find out more at squarespace.com/outofschool.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
With the iPad event, you know. Yeah. So it's the Apple's traditional October event,
which
we have sat and watched together several times over the few years it's been on.
Streaming was fine, I'd like to say.
The streaming worked. Well, I don't know if that indicates that nobody cared this time. what did we get? We got... Well, I think the first fully 25 to 30 minutes of it was essentially a recap of WWDC.
Yeah.
You know, they talked about iOS 8 and they really fudged the adoption numbers. I don't know if you sort of caught that part. They were like, here's how many people are running an operating system released in the last year. You know, not the current version, which was the big thing last year, because they had 97% on iOS 7, whereas now they've only got like 48%. They're like, well, if you add together these two numbers, you get 97%. You know, and then Craig Federighi talking about in air quotes feedback.
Yeah, about I got that. I picked that one up.
Come on, you know, man up a little bit. And take your bumps on that one. You know, that was, I don't know. I thought that was a wee bit. You know, they could have been a little more humble about that.
Yeah,
you know. But I mean, 8.1 is going to be out on Monday, I think.
Yeah,
and,
Monday.
You know, fortunately, we'll be on holiday, so I'll not have the bandwidth to download it. So everybody else can take the risk for a week, and then we'll get it when we come back.
I mean, I have to say, I thought that the overall thing at the beginning was good. Like, I felt the message came across of the connectivity of the whole thing.
Yeah,
I think it may be in some ways better than I've noticed it before. Like.
It was a little more compact than it was at WWDC.
Well, I picked up the kind of overall idea of, because the whole continuity thing.
Yeah.
I had always been like, well, when do I ever start writing a text message and then think, oh, I better finish this on my Mac?
Yeah. You know?
But I guess I kind of more picked up the value of that in terms of.
The demo was tokenally awful.
I loved the video. Oh. I loved the video. I had this handshake thing that I do with my daughter, which is kind of like our special handshake, which has got like half of the moves in it that were in the kind of like the security video, thing. I thought that was fun, but anyway.
So is this a sort of subtle Freemasonic message here, or you know? All these kind of funny handshakes. But
it was good. I'm going to go back and watch that again and add a few moves into our handshake.
That was a much better demo of continuity than when they did at the developer conference, and I think probably it's because they had more of it ready to work.
Yeah.
You know, like doing it in Keynote and things like that, which actually worked pretty well.
It felt pretty relaxed as well, I think, just being in Apple as opposed to...
Yeah.
A huge venue, and like,
of course, that's a much more intimate setting. Yeah, the town hall.
Yeah. It felt very. I thought it felt very relaxed. Everybody on stage felt pretty relaxed.
Yeah. No, it was. It's going to be good. I mean, the things bugs are bugs, and I've been critical of the quality of iOS releases for a couple of years now, at least in the 0.0 versions. But you know, bugs get fixed.
Yeah.
You know, they do, and the question is, how long do they take to get fixed, and how bad are they until they do?
Yeah.
And I mean, iOS 8 has been a little bit rough. It's very rough on an iPhone 6 Plus, so I might add. You've got an iPhone 6, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think people on the 6 are seeing quite the same level, because I think the 6 Plus has got this ability to rotate the springboard as well, and it seems to be that devices with that capability are seeing lots of weird stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas...
Yeah, no, I have to say I've been pretty impressed with my 6.
Yeah.
Really pleased with it.
But you know, bugs get fixed.
Yeah. Right?
And none of this is anything compared to the bug we had in iOS 7 that wiped out all supervision profiles. Because it seems like a trivial bug, but the recovery from that was an absolute monster. Because you eventually had to kind of phone up Apple tech support and give them a list of serial numbers and UDIDs, and they would like generate a custom, you know, a hand built encryption profile they would then email back to you, and you could put it back on your devices.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we've not had anything as bad as that yet.
Yeah, these were the bad days.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously Yosemite is out today as well.
Yeah, and again, I kind of feel, I mean, you've maybe ran the beta for a while. So
I've been running it for a couple of generations.
Whereas for me, it'll be brand new. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. And I suppose the main thing I'm really looking forward to with that is their airdrop between devices.
Yeah.
And that's something actually I find in schools all the time, is people are saying, how do I share this with them, with the kids?
Yeah.
And I want to say all the time, I'm just like, well, the easiest way to do it, AirDrop.
Yeah.
Or how do they share this with me?
Mm-hmm.
And where that becomes annoying is where you've got older generation devices that don't support AirDrop.
And this is one of the problems for a lot of schools that bought heavily into iPad 2.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, their hardware doesn't support it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And we're starting to see some of that stuff with the newer generation of Bluetooth stuff, is that, like they say, well, you know, Yosemite includes continuity and AirDrop between devices, asterisk, only for like the last three generations of Macs that we've produced, you know. So the actual hardware support for that stuff, because even in our school, I see a lot of our teachers, like their Macs are getting quite old.
Yeah.
You know, the Macs that they bring to school, their Macs are old, whereas they've got much more modern iOS hardware.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Yeah, there's a bit of a disconnect there.
Yeah.
And I have to say, some of what they did to tonight on terms of very quickly, but the kind of scroll through the iWork suite and some of the software bumps looked good. I mean, looked really nice. Some of the Keynote, the little bit we saw of Keynote, I thought looked really great. And I think Keynote's the kind of app that can always do with being kept current. You know,
there's a bit of fashion about Keynote.
Yeah, definitely.
Even more so than the other two.
Yeah.
You know, the keeping up with the kind of latest in visual design.
Yeah.
Is important.
And some of the kind of like third party developers that they had, particularly the Pixelmator. I mean, that looked like a great app. I've never even heard of it before. But
well, Pixelmator has been on the Mac for a number of years, and this is it coming to the iPad finally. And, you know, before we were talking before the show today, and I was saying that it would be good to see some new productivity apps being shown.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, I think actually I've been quite pessimistic about that whole area of iPad development. But in fact, if you think about what's happened in the past year, you know, we got the whole Microsoft suite came out. We got refreshed versions of all of the Apple suite. Evernote's coming on really strong. Whole bunch of other apps or a lot of the music apps are really strong on iOS, so it's really not that things are weak. It's just that I think actually discovering new use cases and new kinds of apps is difficult. I just bought the OmniGroup suite for iPad, which has got, you know, the new OmniGraph, OmniPlan, That's a lot of power.
Yeah.
In those devices, yeah. Or in those set of apps.
Yeah.
And of course, OmniFocus 2 for the iPad came out, which is just the greatest thing ever.
You've been waiting for that for a while, probably.
Yeah, so maybe I'm just being unduly pessimistic about some of the iPad stuff. And I think there are certainly categories of software that I feel should be on iPad that aren't yet. In particular, you know, if Apple could bring some kind of development ability to the iPad.
Yeah, so the app development, coding.
Yeah, mm. I think that would be interesting. You know, with like these, they have this thing called Swift Playgrounds, which is like a way to, you can kind of, it's just like a scratch pad for writing programs, and it can actually evaluate it and so on. If you could have even just that, never mind the whole Xcode suite on the iPad, I think that would be, you know, I sort of call them like statement of intent applications.
Yeah.
So when iPad first came out, the presence of the iWork suite on day one was a huge statement of intent.
Yeah.
And then the year after that, we got iMovie for iPad 2 and GarageBand for 1 and 2.
Yeah, which was,
and the year after that, we got iPhoto.
Phenomenal.
You know, I mean, GarageBand was amazing to get that back onto the iPad 1 and the iPad 2 and iMovie. You know, what we can do in iMovie is just, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's been a while since we've seen Apple do another category of iOS software like that.
And I mean, that would be interesting, particularly with, you know, the advent of the watch as well, where, you know, if you were able to then develop on the iPad,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that would be fun. And in school, that might be something that would be an absolute killer,
mm-hmm.
you know, killer app.
There's a number of apps that do sort of coding stuff on the iPad, but there's nothing I've seen that would really satisfy the higher levels of an exam in computer science.
Yeah.
I mean, what we do is we shell out to a Linux server and just compile command line software there, and that meets the requirements, and we use our iPad as an interface to doing it. But it's not really programming on the iPad in that sense.
No, yeah. And I've seen a few apps that are kind of like almost like template builders for apps.
Yeah.
That run on the iPad.
Yeah, sort of like you draw the interface. And
yeah, it's a little bit like kind of Squarespace or Weebly, or the way, you know, we got templates for your blogs that you can do the same sort of thing for mm-hmm. for iPad apps, but mm-hmm. But not so much, not so flexible.
So, I mean, in terms of the hardware that came out today, I think it's, you know, for you and I who go around and talk to people about iPad, I think it's what I was left with at the end was an overriding sense that this is quite a confused landscape.
Mm.
Now, you know, there's now 5 distinct iPad models available, you know. So we've got the iPad Air 2, which is what, the 6th or 7th generation actual iPad.
Yeah.
The iPad Air lives on. There's an iPad Mini 3, which is basically the exact same as an iPad Mini 2, except that it's got Touch ID on it.
Yep.
And you've still got the iPad Mini 2, which is now what they call the iPad, used to be the iPad with Retina display, has now been renamed the iPad Mini 2. And then they're also still selling the A5 based iPad Mini, which is in effect the exact same hardware as an iPad 2.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a...
Yeah, which is what my wife is currently running.
And that's an architecture that just will not die.
Yeah.
You know, this A5 based non-Retina iPad architecture just is living on and on and on.
You know? I mean, I remember we talked about this at the time.
Yeah.
How robust and just what a phenomenal device the iPad 2 actually was
mm-hmm.
in its day. It was just...
Yeah. I mean, it's starting to look very old now. You know. So in some ways, you're kind of like, well, could we maybe just start selling? But the problem is, you know, even if in 2014, A5-based devices were sold as new, it's going to be like 2 years at least. It's going to be 2016 before developers can stop supporting that kind of... And limiting their designs and capabilities for what that device can do. And it's an open question, I think, whether or not the continued existence of those older models is actually what's holding back a lot of the potential of iPad or iOS software in general. Because the phones have moved on from A5 for the most part.
Yeah.
Although they still sell the 4 in some places. But that's a question to me. You know, what would it be if Apple could, in principle, turn over the entire iOS base in 4 years to be all A7 and better?
Yeah.
Would we see a whole category of new apps? Is it, in fact, is the reason that we're not seeing more powerful iOS applications because they've all got to work on an A5 Mini?
Yeah.
It's a question, I don't know.
Yeah.
Possible.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I suppose... That maybe that the kind of very robustness and success of the device can ultimately become something that holds up the progress of the other at the other end, you know.
Possibly, but at the same time, a lot of the devices that are sold are those ones.
Yeah,
you know, like I mean, the original iPad Mini is now under £200.
Yeah,
for Christmas.
Yeah, I noticed that, which is just, I mean, for what you get with that, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Really, genuinely, is amazing.
Yeah.
And even when you compare that, like I was thinking about the price of the phones.
Yeah.
So your phone vastly more expensive than your iPad.
Yeah. Paying a lot for miniaturization, paying a lot for those cellular radios, and I suppose patent fees in some in some cases as well that you don't pay on a tablet.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, focus on the iPad here too for a second. You know, some of my criticisms about that about the iPad in general had been about the, you know, you and I have both got iPad Air.
Yeah.
You know, we got them last year, and I think we're both pretty happy with them overall.
Very happy.
I have really not once in that year sat down and thought, this iPad's getting a bit long in the tooth.
No.
I can't wait for an update.
No.
What I have felt, and I don't know if you felt the same, is that many of the things that need to be fixed with the iPad are not about its internal components as much as about its industrial design.
Yeah.
And by that I mean things like the reflectivity of the screen.
Well, I noticed this today. I was just like,
we must have been listening earlier. Yeah. And that's, to me, you know, the two things, the two major new things in the iPad Air 2 are the bonded screen that reduces reflectivity and the upgraded camera.
Camera, yeah.
And the camera now has all kinds of capabilities. You know, it's got lower light capabilities, it's got time lapse, slow mo. Oh, it's not got the 240 frames per second mode that the new phones have got. And it's got these so-called burst selfies, right? So you can take a burst mode.
Whoopee.
Yeah, so that'll be all our kids will just be filling up their phones with that. But to me, those were two of my main criticisms of the iPad in the classroom, was that when you've got classroom lighting fixed in whatever way it is, then the glare from an iPad screen can be problematic.
Yeah, it can set it on. And if you ever try to photograph an iPad screen, it's really annoying.
Yeah. And then secondly, the fact that the iPad camera, I mean, okay, it still lags behind the iPhone camera.
Yeah.
Probably just for reasons of cost, you know, because the iPad simply isn't as expensive as the equivalent phone. That has been an important tool in school. And I think what you saw when they were talking about the quality of the camera was they actually did call out a number of specific kind of education or education-related use cases for that.
Yeah.
And I've always looked at that. You know, they talked about using it for OCR scanning of a document and things, and I've always described the camera as much a data capture sensor as a photography tool in the classroom.
Yeah.
You know.
Definitely.
Photography part's just one element.
Absolutely. And I think that's key in terms of just so much of what we do, the camera is an integral part of. Even if it's as simple as, you know, if you're keeping a record of whatever, you can just photograph it and put it in the profile. But there's nothing to stop. There's nothing wrong with that. That's absolutely fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what's great, I think, about the iPad. It's all there.
Yeah.
The camera looked amazing.
Yeah.
New camera.
I think that's going to be a big win for schools. And of course, the other thing is the storage levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so 128.
Instead of the four levels they used to have on the iPad Air, where they had 16, 32, 64, and 128, we've now got 16 for why, I don't know, 64 and 128.
Yeah.
Now you've got a 64,
yeah, 64.
From last time, I've got a 128 from last time.
And is that, would you buy that again?
To be honest with you, about half of that space lies unused most of the time, but every so often there comes along a time or a project where I end up using a whole lot of it.
Yeah.
You know, like right now we're doing the presentation assessments, and I'm storing a lot of video in there because I'm building up a portfolio of videos, and I end up growing a huge chunk of video and then rendering it all at the end and then getting it off.
Yeah.
So I kind of grow the use of my iPad and then it falls off quite dramatically. But the nice thing about that is that, you know, both of us, if were we to buy the equivalent iPad again, we'd be getting it for $100 less.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I think the 64 is quite a big win for schools, because a lot of schools, particularly you know, middle school and above have started to go beyond 16 gigs. Yep. In our last deployment, we went to 32. And basically, for the same money, next time we'll get double storage.
Yeah.
You know, we're not getting at an entry level, but because we've already gone beyond the entry level, we'll now get, we'll get 64s yeah. next time.
Which is great. And it is something that I think, one thing that I noticed that I think sometimes schools haven't really thought about. Yeah. It's very difficult to think about it entirely before you've, before you know what this yeah. world is going to be like that you're walking into. And, you know, so you, you know, I see regularly teachers that have been supplied with a 16 gig iPad.
And they're struggling to use
it. Well, they can't update to iOS 8, for example.
This has been a huge issue.
There is no way. They just don't have the room. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I would... It's one thing that quite often you'd love to be able to say to people at the beginning of the deployment, you know, yeah. forget the 16, 32 minimum, you know, yeah. probably 64 ideally.
Yeah.
For certainly for teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the more you do, I mean, we're recording this show on my iPad. That's going to be a 650 to 800 meg audio file that I'm going to then manipulate and work on that device. And having the 128 gig iPad there means I can just start recording. I can sit here for an hour and talk to you, and I don't even have to think about whether or not I've got enough storage to make that work.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that level of working on an iPad that justifies 128 gig
yeah.
device.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, that's the same amount of storage I had on my first MacBook Air. 128 gig.
Yeah.
The first flash. It's one crazy. I had, you know. And it's got more pixels in its screen than that yeah, laptop has.
It's crazy,
well, you know, and it costs less. but yeah, these sort of, I mean, I've described these in the show notes as sort of undead iPads shuffling around, these older models.
Yeah.
You know, it's got, it just looks very confusing to somebody walking into an Apple store.
What do you buy and
what
why?
What do I buy and yeah. why? Yeah. You know, and particularly when things like the iPad Mini 3, like, all it is an iPad Mini 2 with a Touch ID sensor. Mm. Why are those two products? Well, they charge $100 more just for the Touch ID sensor, yeah. but...
I guess it's covering every price point, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is but, it? I mean, is that...
But at what cost?
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, the more choices you get somebody to make when they walk into the store, the more chance they will walk out and make no choice.
Mm.
You know, and I think... When the iPad came out, it was really simple. I get an iPad, I choose the storage, and I choose whether or not I want cellular. And now you've got to choose what screen size you want. Do you want Touch ID? Do you not? Do you want a Retina display or not in the case of the Mini? And then you're starting to ask about how much storage do I want? Well, what if I want 64? Well, I can only get 64 in the new model. I can't get 64 in the old model.
Yeah.
You know, I want 32, but I can't get 32 unless I also get a Retina display. You know, there's the decision tree for figuring out what iPad you buy now is actually quite substantial.
Yeah.
And that reminds me of the bad old days of Apple. You know, that reminds me of the 90s when you had 40 different consumer models to choose from. You know, there are actually 128 possible kinds of iPad you could get now.
Mm.
If you count up all the cellular technologies, all the storage levels, all the colors, all the screen sizes, all the, you know, different models. You know, to me, that just feels... Can't why does it have to be that complicated?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I suppose. I mean, I don't know the answer to that, obviously, but I'm thinking just of like, for example, my mom,
mm-hmm.
who is still running an iPad 1,
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, loving it and thoroughly enjoying it, but it is gradually dying. You know, and it's been an amazing machine for her.
Mm-hmm.
But when that dies, she'll want another one. Now, she would probably, I can't really see that she would ever want anything more than she could get in the $199 iPad Mini.
Yeah.
Apart from maybe the screen size. But, you know, but I guess there's really nothing for her beyond that. There's no need for her to have any more than that. She'll,
mm-hmm.
that will live for her. You know, she'll get a fair amount of lifespan out of that because yeah. of the use that she has for it.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe there's a hugely expanded range of people, and with them using iPad and with them.
Yeah, I mean, when you're serving half a billion people,
yeah.
you know, you've got to provide more options.
Yeah,
for sure. But I think even at that, there's now some points in the lineup now where I think. You know, if you said to me, I want to use my iPad for X, Y, and Z, there would still be two or three models I could equally recommend.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just be like, you basically, you're asking, do you want to pay $100 for a Touch ID sensor?
Yeah.
You know. And that seems weird to me.
Yeah.
You know, like why not just upgrade everything to Touch ID and be done with it? You know, is the component really that expensive? Maybe it is that you've got to pass the cost on.
Mm.
You know. But I think they also want to drive the entry price lower and lower and lower, you know, to compete against everybody.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
You think about the iPod Shuffle. Back in the day, I mean, how good was the iPod Shuffle?
Yeah.
Not very, except for a few very specific use cases. But the iPad is presented as such a generic use case device that people think if they get an iPad, they can do all these things they've seen on the adverts.
Yeah.
And in fact, in large part, you actually can't do a lot of those things you've seen on the adverts. You can't do any iMovie on a 16 gig device.
No.
You know, you put a nice camera in it, but you sell it at 16 gig storage, you know.
Mm.
And you and I know some people who have bought iPhone 6s and 6 pluses at 16 gigs of storage.
Yeah.
And you're just asking yourself, why did you do that?
Yeah.
Because you know, you're
it doesn't make any sense at all.
You're storing problems for yourself, not even in the future, but basically within 6 weeks.
Yeah, right now.
You know, yeah. You've the already
minute,
got a problem.
The minute you've spent a day taking photographs and you've taken a few slow-mo videos.
Yeah. 240 frames per second videos are huge.
You'll be going back for a new one. Yeah. I'll tell you the one thing I would love, because I'm sure it must be something that is on the cards because enough people are talking about it. But I'm looking forward to the day now where my iPad screen is a little bigger.
Yeah, that didn't come, and that was certainly rumoured to come.
Yeah.
And I think there's more has to happen in that story, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And I can understand why it didn't, and it seems to me to make sense when you think about the progression that seems to have happened over the years recently with iPhone 4, iPhone 4S, iPhone 5, iPhone 5S, iPhone 6, and so on. So I understand that almost what we've got, the Air 2, is a kind of 5S product. It almost really isn't.
Yes, I suppose it isn't.
Whereas I'm kind of looking forward to it. And I'm at the moment, I'm not thinking about really upgrading my iPad Air on the basis of tonight's announcement, much as I really enjoyed bits of it. And I thought they looked, you know, for a new iPad, it looks phenomenal. Just friendly, not that's upgrading or whatever. It just looks like a great upgrade. But I really will be excited about the day when the screen's a little bigger.
In some ways, the iPad has to have its iPhone 6 Plus moment.
Yeah.
You know, it has to have that break in continuity with the past that the iPhone never had until the 6 and 6 Plus came out.
Yeah.
And
you love your 6 Plus.
Oh, yeah. Huge, huge fan. You know, wouldn't go back for anything. And I'm aware that it's not for everybody, but then again, you're serving 500 million people. You've got to offer these choices.
Mm.
And I think with the iPad, you know, the iPad has sort of consistently been this one thing, and then it's been a smaller thing, which is essentially still the same thing, just shrunk. But, you know, how far does that go? Because, you know, like all the Macs have got the same software capability. This is the thing that's kind of different between iOS devices and Macs, is that you get Macs from 11.9 inches all the way up to 27 inches, and they all have exactly the same software capabilities down to the, you know, apart from those that have Retina displays and those that don't, but beyond that, they've essentially the same software capabilities, whereas on iOS, you now see, you know, if you're a certain size, you can do some things. You know, if you're 4.7 inches or below, you get to do a certain set of things. If you're 5.5 inches, you get to do this thing where you rotate and you get a 2-up display. And then if you're 8.9 inches or above, you get to do these other things that are iPad-style things. And I hope to see, you know, more continuity in that over time as well.
Yeah.
I think that would be...
Yeah, but it did feel with the whole, you know, the whole continuity piece felt like that was kind of... The whole thing is feeling more kind of united, I think.
Yeah, I think it's certainly, you know, it makes less and less sense, I think, to talk about iOS and OS X as much as talking about the Apple platform as a whole.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's kind of where it may be going, is that it doesn't matter. And they sort of almost hinted at saying that towards the end of the presentation.
I thought
they sort of said, here's everything we make. Everybody's going to make their own choices out of this set, but we want it to work either standalone or as a suite, whichever parts of it you choose. So if you have a watch, a phone, and a 27-inch iMac, those will work together well. Whereas if you've got an iPad and a 15-inch MacBook Pro, and that's all you've got, those two will work together well, yeah, and any other combination of same.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's,
you just need to work out which ones you actually need.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when they sort of started to kind of articulate that a little bit back before iOS 8 was announced, I looked at that with some trepidation because I thought, well, that basically is saying that you're going to have a Mac and your selection of iOS devices. Whereas I feel that after, like post iOS 8, that you could actually conceivably just choose the smaller half of that range. You could have an all iOS experience and you would still be afforded a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is just how close to will they let all of those things come together? Will they actually let people become iPad only owners, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I say let in the sense that will you be allowed to do the same range of things on iOS as you can do on a Mac?
Yeah.
With no exceptions.
Yeah.
Or will there always be exceptions to what is permitted is a word because of the App Store review.
Yeah.
You know, will you always be permitted to do the same kinds of things in iOS that you do in the Mac?
Yeah.
Time will tell.
Yeah. Exciting days ahead, I think.
Yeah, we should probably leave it there. I mean, they did something with the Macs as well. we've obviously focused on you know, iOS.
Yeah.
But the Retina iMac, you know, I never thought they would do a 27-inch Retina display.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe within my lifetime.
What we're talking about, though, it is phenomenal, isn't it, really? Yeah. I mean, I remember how excited you were about the Retina display on the first time it appeared on an iPad.
Yeah, when we got those iPad 3s and went from iPad 2 upwards.
And to be honest, that was not a great iPad, but the display was amazing.
To me, that justified everything else. Yeah. I mean, there were many, many things wrong with the third-generation iPad, but that display. And now we're so kind of used to it.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know. I guess I just don't feel the same excitement for the Mac anymore, you know.
Yeah, it feels to me, I suppose as well in what I'm doing at the moment, it feels like that is somehow something from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that might not be true, and I'm sure it's not true for a lot of people, but the whole portability, you know, the mobility, the personalization of the device, all these kind of fundamentals in education are such kind of powerful drivers for going with an iOS device.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And the number of use cases within the classroom for a Mac, I think are really less and less. For the most part, although obviously what we've said about some of the upper years of education and the filtering towards the exam systems and all that sort of stuff, then you know, maybe there's a conversation there.
Yeah, that's probably another show for another time. Yeah. But you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, there are some people who depend on specific tools on the Mac for their job, right? No question about
graphic
it.
Designers, your music producers,
your pros, your professional people, even writers, you know, who depend on the desktop version of Microsoft Word, none other will do.
Yeah.
But increasingly for the consumer or just the average person, so much of that has migrated to the web.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, between,
yeah,
we talked a lot about Google Docs in this show, but, you know, accounting software that we use is web-based now, and Evernote is, you know, good on the web now as well, and so many of these things are web-based that I feel personally that my use of the Mac is increasingly just is OmniFocus, Messages, and Safari.
Yeah.
You know, and that's basically how I spend my life on the Mac,
is
the full desktop web, quote-unquote. We complained about that in the last show, actually, with Safari on iOS. And then a few ancillary apps. But in fact, almost all of my time that I spend in native apps, I spend it on iOS.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do a wide range of things on my iPad in native apps, much wider on the iPad than I do on the Mac.
Yeah.
And I tend to retreat to the Mac for those large-scale web tasks, if you like. You know, I'm researching a holiday to go on. I'll maybe do that on the Mac because I need to see a big map of where the flights go or whatever.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I guess we just wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
You know, if people do come out with great new use cases on the Mac, great. But often, I find myself sort of using the Mac as a debugging tool for iOS devices.
Yeah.
You know, something's wrong with the network, something's wrong with, you know, the printer or whatever, and it's the problem manifests itself on iOS devices, mm-hmm. but I've got to go back to the Mac to get the tools to fix it. And more I'd like to see those tools be available on iOS
yeah.
as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wonder sometimes, I'd wondered part of me tonight whether there would be a kind of a, you know, move for something like iBooks Author
mm-hmm.
to iOS.
Yeah.
Because that would almost become kind of Keynote, Pages.
That would be the full
iBooks Author. Yeah, yeah, you really, yeah. you're kind of... But I mean, I suppose part of me tonight feels like, yeah, I'm fairly satisfied, but I'm really looking forward to what I'll be feeling next year at this time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of a year of incremental upgrades yeah. for the iPad line.
Yeah,
and I suppose the huge upgrade we've had is iOS 8.
Yeah,
and we've all got that.
Yeah,
and this is it's even better for the people who are buying into iPad now.
Yeah,
but to me, it doesn't really change the dynamic of why would more people buy an iPad just yet. I think in many ways, if Apple would advertise iOS 8 a bit more, you know, in terms of like what you can do with extensions, what you can do with iCloud Drive, you know, and just tell people, hey, you know, all those reasons why like a year ago you looked at an iPad and said that's a stupid thing that I don't want to use. Why don't you come back and have another look now?
Yeah.
You know, get those people back yeah. in. You know, the people yeah. who are curious at the start and rejected it. That would be useful.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to say I'm really loving iOS 8.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame that they're slightly tainted with bugs and, you know,
yeah.
initial rollout issues when it's actually fundamentally just an amazing, amazing operating system.
To me, iOS 8 is the feature set that iPad has always wanted.
Yeah.
The quality needed to be better and the quality will have to get better, no question about it. But this is now the operating system that the iPad Air should have had all along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the iPad Air came with that level of performance and capacity that made it possible to bring in more of these tasks, but iOS 7 wasn't really quite up to the task.
Mm-hmm.
And now with iOS 8, I'm finding that, you know, people ask me on Twitter all the time, how much are you using your iPad now that you've got an iPhone 6 Plus? And the answer is I'm using it tons. I'm probably using it more now.
Yeah.
But not because it's nothing to do with what size my phone is, as much as it's to do with what's now possible with iOS 8.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think it's iOS 8 that has expanded my use of the Mac. And in fact, everything has been pushed up.
Yeah.
And it's still, for me, it's still the Mac that's getting squeezed at the top
yeah.
end.
Yeah.
Rather than the iPad getting yeah. squeezed out in the middle.
Yeah.
For me, because I value all those things that you mentioned earlier, the mobility and the immediacy, the integration of the camera, you know, just yeah. the all-in-oneness yeah. of the iPad is still really, really influential to
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
And that last 10% of power or whatever is not so important in my life anymore as it used to be when I was developing software, for example.
Yeah.
You know, so. Shall we leave it there?
Good. Yeah, all that right. was great. Good chat.
Yeah, where can people find you online?
So I am just at Andrew Jewell on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And my website is andrewjewelleducation.com.
Okay, and I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web. And we'll talk to you next week.